most of you were here either Sunday or last Friday, but we talked about how we are going to pause the Pentateuch for a little bit and take an excursion to wisdom literature, largely motivated by the fact that I'm teaching a class on wisdom literature this semester. And so for last week, we kind of did an overview of wisdom literature as a whole, and we talked about the fact that Job, Psalms, and Proverbs, at least in my estimation, really constitute the wisdom literature. The class I'm teaching also includes Psalms within that, but I probably wouldn't call that wisdom literature. I like to call that worship. So that's wisdom and worship, if you like to alliterate. So when it comes to the wisdom literature, just to remind ourselves briefly, with those three books, a couple of distinctive things. One, they're much more focused to individuals rather than the nation as a whole. And so we see that individualistic focus of how the righteous man or woman is to live, as opposed to how the nation as a whole should live in covenant with God. And so there's a whole section of the Old Testament that's even broader than the wisdom literature that's kind of has a more individual focus, which is called the writings in the Hebrew canon. And the wisdom literature fits within that. And then we also talked about the fact that with both Job's Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, I would see the main point of all three of those books the same, which is interesting that the main point would be identical, but yet they each take a different angle and a different perspective when looking at that subject. And I would say that theme is the fear of Yahweh. We looked at that and we talked about how in Proverbs, right at the beginning, it starts off that the purpose of Proverbs is to gain wisdom and understanding. And you could read the first few verses there, and we'll dive into that. I think next week we'll probably jump into Proverbs more in depth. And we talked about how Ecclesiastes ends the whole book after talking about how everything under the sun is futile and meaningless and worthless in a sense. And that long discussion, it ends the book by, here's the sum of the matter, fear God and keep his commandments. And I would say that that really is the controlling theme of that book as well. And then we also looked at Job and how I would see chapter 28 as being the key chapter within the book of Job, where in the first couple chapters, three times it mentions that Job is a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. And then that phrase, fears God and turns away from evil, doesn't occur anywhere else in the book except for chapter 28, which is kind of, I don't know what the right word is, but ironically, that's not the right word, but it's the whole context around chapter 28 is these debates going back and forth between Job and his friends, and they're very, I don't know what the right word is, they're disputes, they're kind of, you know, harsh in a sense. And then all in the middle of it all, there's this just serene chapter on wisdom and this, what I would call this ode to wisdom and the greatness of wisdom. And at the end of that poem, it says the same thing, that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And so all three of these books I would suggest to you are wisdom literature. How to obtain wisdom is their main point. And all three of them have ultimately the same message, and that's to fear God is how you obtain wisdom. And so as we did on Sunday, we kind of overviewed the book of Job as a whole. And due to just time limitations there, I thought it would be good to pick up that again. And obviously in a setting like this, we have a lot more opportunity to interact. And just in the past when I've preached sermons, I found it very helpful, and I think other people have as well, to spend time, you know, somewhat discussing the same thing, but maybe getting to different aspects of it that we didn't have time to discuss on Sunday, and to really, in this kind of a setting, be able to think through that more carefully. And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to come back to Job, and then, as I said on Sunday, next week we're going to come back to Job Sunday, this coming Sunday, and look at a more narrow aspect of it. Just look at a particular passage in Job 19, which is such a famous passage. I know that my Redeemer lives, and we all know and that love that passage. So I'll look at that in its context. But this evening, once again, just want to come and look at kind of the overall theme of Job and kind of narrow in on some things that maybe we passed over briefly on Sunday. And so I think most of you were there, if not all of you. Boucher's weren't there, but I'll just briefly kind of review some of the main things, but I would, you know, think about if you do have questions, you know, if you were awake on Sunday or whatever, and, you know, just to think through together just this main purpose and how it relates to our lives, and just kind of think through some of the application. Obviously, Job is a huge book, and there's a lot of different ways, directions that we could take this, but just to kind of continue to look at what it means to fear God from the book of Job. So briefly, let me just kind of review, and please stop me if you have a question, because we are just going to spend our time this evening kind of thinking about some of the implications that we mentioned briefly on Sunday. Let's see, probably the best place to start is at the beginning in chapter 1, and we went over it so quickly on Sunday that I think it would be helpful to us. You know, I know I mentioned some of these things, but just in passing. So let's go ahead and read all of chapter 1. Maybe let's just read the first two chapters, because really I think these chapters set up so much what the main point of the book is. So does anyone want to read maybe chapter 1? Someone else can read chapter 2.
I'll read chapter 1.
Okay.
Just a moment. All right. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. The sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." And thus Job did continually. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil." And Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now, there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and there came a messenger to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing, the donkeys feeding beside them. And the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, there came another and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "Your daughters and sons were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the 4 corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And in all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong.
Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. And he still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause." Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. However, put forth your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh. He will curse you to your face." So the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your power. Only spare his life." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, they came each one from his own place: Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. And they made an appointment together to come to sympathize with him and comfort him. When they lifted up their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him, they raised their voices and wept. And each of them tore his robe, and they threw dust over their heads toward the sky. Then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights, with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great.
There we have it, the introduction to the book of Job. And as we even meditate on Sunday, obviously just Job's awesome response to this amazing trial, that he loses everything. And as we see in verses 20 and 21, he falls to the ground and worships. And he says, "Blessed be the name of Yahweh." And it doesn't really give his response, you know, when he loses his health, but it's kind of assumed that it's similar response to how he responded the first time when he lost all his children. And it's just amazing. And of course, the question we had to ask ourselves is, how could he do this? And as we saw on Sunday, the theme of this book really is, it's because he feared Yahweh. It's because he understood the greatness of Yahweh. He believed in Yahweh. And as we talked about, you know, he didn't know why this was happening. He didn't understand that, you know, if you read throughout the whole book, you study the book, you see he doesn't have any idea that Satan, that there's this whole story went on between Satan and God. And I want to spend a little bit more time developing what happens there, because I think there's some great lessons for us. But we have to keep in mind that, you know, the author of the narrative gives us this cosmic view of as what's happening in heaven, but Job doesn't have that. And I think that's one of the key things that this book is really seeking to instill within us, is an understanding that if we really fear God, we'll understand our place is down here and God's is up there. And that's why I would say that the fear of the Lord does become that key element of what it means to be wise. And we'll see this develop throughout all three of these books. It's because if you want to be wise, if you want to live in such a way that's successful according to God, you have to be dependent upon Him for knowing how to respond. And so each one of these three books, whether it be Job or Proverbs or Ecclesiastes, each takes a different angle. And here in the book of Job, you see that you need God in order to walk wisely, because you're too finite. You're too small. You don't understand what's going on cosmically. You have to trust God that He's the one that's in control of those things. And so the book, as it opens up, sets up in quite a grand way a very global, cosmic setting, if you want. I think that's what's so fascinating this book starts off is God's reputation is kind of at the stake, on the line, right from the outset of this book. You know, it's interesting how this starts off, right? Some of it's just kind of fascinating, even just from a curiosity standpoint. Apparently, these sons of God, it seems pretty clear in the text here in verse 6 that these are angels, if I could use that terminology. Spiritual beings, obviously including Satan, so not all of them were good. And they come and they present themselves between Yahweh and Satan was among them. So that's kind of curious, just even in and of itself, that God, these beings have access to God himself. And so Yahweh is the one that introduces this whole book. He introduces everything by asking Satan a question, from where do you come? And it obviously he says, you know, I'm roaming about, walking around on the earth. And Yahweh says to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? It's interesting as you start off this whole book that Yahweh is the initiator here. Yahweh is the one who you could see throughout this whole book is the one that's in control of the events. And obviously we know that God's in control, but when you have it in a story form like this, it really re-emphasizes and helps you to see that God's the one that's, if I could use the metaphor, is playing the cards here to really show off, in a sense, his servant Job and to show off himself. And you see that from the outset, God is really concerned with his reputation. He's concerned with, I think we'll see, his own glory on a cosmic level, even in terms of showing that to Satan. And so I think what this contributes to the book is an understanding that, we focused on Job's response, but it's a reminder that we don't always know what's going on. It's a reminder to try to help us keep perspective. And that's what this book is trying to help us do, to understand how awesome God is and how finite we are. He's so awesome, as we even read that section near the end of Job, where maybe, I don't know if we'll have time to get there again tonight, where God just finally speaks out of the whirlwind and shows his awesome majesty in creation and Leviathan and Behemoth and just this awesome description of his power to really put Job in his place. And from the beginning, maybe not in the same kind of humbling way, but I'd say that this introduction also very much functions to help us to see our finiteness, not only in terms of our power, but in terms of our wisdom. And that's really, I think, the emphasis here is, look how finite we are, right? God, even in God's speech, he keeps talking about how much wisdom he had in ordering all of creation, right? And we could, you know, maybe go there and it's like, you know, could you do this? Do you know how to, like, make everything work in this world? Do you know how to make all the animal kingdom and all the humanity and everything work out and orchestrate just perfectly? Do you have that kind of wisdom? And obviously Job's response is no. And so you see throughout this whole book, there's a continual, in a sense, humbling of man so that we will see our complete dependence on God. And so right at the outset, that perspective is given that's cosmic, I guess, is probably the best word for it. God is doing something bigger than any one individual. This is not so much about Job as it is about God. And so right off the bat, you know, as we said in verse 8, God, Yahweh, starts bragging on Job. You know, he's a blameless and upright man. And ultimately, I think we'll see, we talked about this a little bit on Sunday, but this is really, I think, so much at the heart of the book. When Job has absolutely everything taken away from him, he shows what he truly values. Or I should say, it shows what he truly values. He doesn't serve God for the stuff he can get. And that's really what verse 9 says. Then Satan says, answered Yahweh, does Job fear God for nothing? And it's a rhetorical question. What does Satan think the answer is? He thinks,
yes.
Yeah, he serves God for no good reason. You know, he serves God for the stuff he can get, right? He's, you know, God, you're not valuable in and of yourself. You're not glorious in and of yourself. It's just if you give stuff to people, then they'll serve you. You're just kind of like, a Santa Claus. You know, you give people enough, they'll do what you want. You know, it's because you give them stuff. Right? And so, ultimately, what's on trial here is Job's faith. Right? And that's what we've seen here. He doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't have that perspective. But God, because he really wants to show himself as glorious, he wants Job to worship him and serve him, not for his gifts, but because of who he is. Right? That's what he really wants here. That's what God is desiring to show to Satan and to everyone else, that Job's faith is genuine, that Job doesn't serve me just for what I give him. And obviously that's what plays out as we follow through the narrative. But you could see right from the outset that that's what Satan's accusation is in verses 9 and 10 and 11 there. You know, Satan says, as he finishes up verse 11, "Put forth your hand now and touch all that he has. He will surely curse you to your face." Right? You know, if you take everything away from him, if he has nothing left, he'll curse you. Because he's only serving you, he's only blessing you for what he gets out of it. Now, let me just pause there for a second. Because I think, you know, obviously Job doesn't know what's going on here. But you see that God in heaven really designed for this whole trial to go through, for Job to go through this massive trial in his life for a perspective that's much bigger than Job himself. Do we see that in the text? We see kind of that God's the one that initiated this, that God's the one. And I recognize that, I guess in one sense, we're reading a little bit between the lines when we talk about God's glory being the purpose here. But I think that you can draw those connections pretty clearly, that God is the one that set this up. Satan wasn't the one who, you know, initiated the conversation. I'd say it's part of the way that the author tells the story to show that God's the one that initiates it. And I think the reason that he does that is to show that God is setting out to do something when he, in a sense, sets up this confrontation with Satan. Right? It's kind of like, you know, I don't know how to describe it. It's like, hey, Satan. It's almost like he's picking a fight. That's probably a good way of putting it. He's, hey, Satan, look at Job. Look at how, you know, he knows that even it's almost comical in the sense that you could just imagine it between two humans. It's like, you know, hey, look at what I did. You know, you're kind of asking for a comment in return, you know, and obviously because Satan being the antagonist that he is, right, you could see that God is the one that sets this up. And so once again, God is doing this for a purpose, right? And Job doesn't know this purpose, but ultimately I think you see it when you see Job's response. You see his worship and you see that that God is worth worshiping and serving apart from nothing else. And that's what's so important here to see, is that God is intrinsically and inherently valuable and worthy to be worshiped apart from his gifts. Does that make sense? Do you have any questions about that? Because I think that just establishing from the outset God's purpose in testing Job, I think should have the effect of causing us, when we go through trials, when we go through difficulties, when, as often is the case, finite humans, we don't understand what's going on, it should cause us to remind ourselves that God is bigger than us. That, you know, we should fear him and trust that he's doing something good. We can't always understand, you know, what's going on, and we can't always rationalize and figure everything out. And it's an important contribution that this book makes, because as we'll look at throughout, you know, much of the rest of the Old Testament, throughout wisdom literature, throughout the Pentateuch that we're going through, there's this concept that God blesses obedience. Right? If you obey, God will bless you. If you disobey, God will curse you. And that's true. We'll see that, as I said, throughout much of the Old Testament, that concept keeps coming up and up over and over again. But what this book shows us is that it's not a one-to-one correspondence, not a perfect correspondence where every time you obey, magically from heaven, this blessing appears. And there's a reason for that. If that was the case, it wouldn't take any faith. Right? It wouldn't take any faith if every time you had integrity, God magically gave you $1,000 in, you know, gold that appeared out of heaven. Right? It doesn't take any faith then, right? It's just like, okay, I get exactly, you know, and every time you disobey this, you know, I don't know what, this fire from heaven comes down and scorches you a little bit, you know? It's like, okay, you know, if it was that much of a one-to-one correspondence between obedience, there would be no need for faith. And so God wants to elevate faith. He wants to show that he's worth serving, he's worth following, he's worth being worshipped over, even when there's no tangible reward that you can see. Does that make sense? I hope you all see how clearly he proves that with Job. Right? There can be no earthly reason why Job serves God, right? He loses it all. Even his wife tells him to curse God and die. Right? There's nothing that he could look around and say, this is what I'm serving God for. It's only God himself. And so such an important lesson for us as we come to the beginning of this is it really sets this narrative framework. It sets the God's purposes behind this and elevates those and shows us, you know, like I said, Job never sees that. Job never gets to kind of look behind the curtain and see what's going on between God and Satan. But the author shows us that so that hopefully when we go through a trial where we can't see this, we'll remember and we'll keep that perspective in mind that, oh yeah, right? Oh yeah, God is the one who's in control. Oh yeah, I mean, I think if you just put yourself in Job's shoes, it helps us to think, you know, we could kind of make that connection with it in his case. We can all read through Job and it's like, oh yeah, of course God's doing something good here. He had to prove Satan wrong. He had to show that he was glorious and that it's not about his gifts. It's about him as an awesome God that's worth serving. And we kind of read that and we get it. But then we get thrown into our own situation, right? We get thrown into the midst of some trial that we can't understand, and we ask all the why questions, and sometimes we can't come to an answer. And so hopefully the book of Job will teach us maybe the answer's not the same. Maybe it's not because Satan had a conversation with God and Satan's tempting us, but the lesson is God's in control. God's working out something. God knows what he's doing, and he's worth serving and worshiping apart from his gifts. Okay? Let me just kind of pause there for a second and see if there's any questions, any further applications.
You kind of get the idea that whenever something happens to you, you think, oh, God must be teaching me something. And there's something that Job teaches us, though, is that maybe he's not. Maybe he's asking you to apply something that you already know, not learn something new. He's not trying to tell you to look at something differently. He's trying to tell you, look at what you already know.
Yeah, it's good. That's a good point. I mean, I think, like, as you say, the book of Job teaches us that ultimately our response should be to look to God. You know, and that could be, it potentially could cause us to see, hey, was there some sin in my life that I need to repent of, you know? But that doesn't mean that you keep inwardly gazing and looking. And obviously Job would teach us that that wasn't the case in his place. And also teaches us, too, I think a lot about circumstances. We've talked a lot about the fact that, about God-ordained circumstances. And we obviously believe that circumstances are God-ordained. But I think if this book teaches us anything, it teaches us that we can't always figure out why. We can't always look at a circumstance and go, oh, I can interpret this circumstance. I know exactly what I'm supposed to do here. Right? I mean, in terms of like, I mean, obviously the right response is always to worship and to have a right attitude and response to God. But we can't always figure out, in one sense, what God is doing with a circumstance. Right? Just because, you know, just because God, quote unquote, closes a door, what does that mean? Does that mean that I shouldn't try to go through that door? Or does that mean that God's trying to teach me perseverance and I should keep knocking until he opens it? Right? The circumstance in and of itself doesn't teach us that. And we see that God's purposes and his ways are beyond us. And that ultimately we need to keep coming back to our to him, coming back to his word for wisdom. And that's, as I said, all three of these wisdom books, that's what they teach us. They teach us, keep coming back here. Keep coming back to God, because you cannot figure it out on your own. And that's why, as you walk throughout these wisdom literature books, the fear of Yahweh is the controlling principle. You want to be wise, you have to start with fearing Yahweh. And once again, that doesn't mean, it's more of an aspect of understanding your place in relation to God than this, how should I say, just terror. I mean, I'm certainly the emotional aspect of fear is present, but I think why it's such an important concept for wisdom literature is because the fear of the Lord is to say, you are great, I am not, I need to submit myself to you. I need your wisdom. You know, I can't figure this out on my own. And so all three of these books really teach us that we need to keep being driven back to our own lowness, our own humility, and as, you know, our own lack of wisdom, that's where we have to start. And that's what all three of these books teach us, is that you can't figure it all out. Well, when we get into Proverbs, that's how Proverbs starts off too. It starts off with the whole 9 chapters just teaching you over and over again, seek wisdom. You need wisdom. Seek after it. You're not there yet. And if you don't start with that, if you don't start with, I need wisdom, you're never going to get wisdom. And so we'll look at that next Friday when we come to Proverbs. We'll start into those first 9 chapters. If you don't start with, I need wisdom, you'll never obtain wisdom. And Job teaches us the same thing. If you don't understand that God is so far above you that you can't figure it out, you'll never submit to him and seek wisdom from him. Okay, so I hopefully that, I mean, in one sense, it's a lot of repetition from what we did talk about on Sunday, but hopefully when taking a little bit of a different angle at it, it helps it to sink in that much more, and how that all fits together, how Job's faith in God, which was shown to be real through this trial, how that fits into his fear of God, where he seeks, you know, he understands, and the reason he worships is because he understands that God is above him, and his response is just to worship and acknowledge God's greatness and his own humility before God.
I have one question and one comment. Do you think the reason then that the Hebrew people consider Job to be wisdom literature or its class like that is because a good portion of the book is Job discussing with these friends of his how to be wise in relationship to God? Like, no, you're dumb, that's a dumb idea. You should think about it this way instead. Like, because I've often wondered, why would a person consider this wisdom literature? Because it's not so much like a lot of, what were the others? We've got Solomon's Proverbs.
Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. Yeah.
Ecclesiastes, and those are all very easily believable, but are we saying that, like, the major portion of the book, Job's talking about, like, okay, you're thinking this way, you're seeing just the circumstances to his friends, but really God could be doing something different, God's purposes could be different, is that why?
Well, I would say that, I mean, that's related, but I would say it has a lot to do with the structure of the book in chapter 28, and that's kind of what I was saying. I would say that the whole structure of the book is basically like red flashing arrows pointing to chapter 28 that says, this is the main point. And so I would say that, and the whole, I guess I could just briefly walk through how each section fits into that. You know, if chapter 28 is all about fearing Yahweh, that's what wisdom is. As we said, it's a whole ode to wisdom. And as we start off the book, Job, the main thing that characterizes Job is he's a man who fears God. That's the repetition 3 times about Job. And so in the first 2 chapters, I think it's somewhat obvious how Job's fear of God is kind of what leads him to do this and to act this way, just because it's that the fact that he fears God and turns away from evil, that phrase is repeated so many times, it's clearly an emphasis of the author that's why Job responds this way. And so you see that in the first 2 chapters, that so Job...
There's this huge block of this,
right.
these people who go.
Debate back and forth.
Why so much of that, and why would that be considered the wisdom part? Or is it just the book as a whole?
The book as a whole, I would say.
So it just happens that there's so much of this.
Right. Yeah, I think so. And it plays into the purpose, and why so much of this debate back and forth between... Basically, the argument between Job's friends and Job is, Job's friends say, and really, it's to, I would say it all keeps reemphasizing the same point, that ultimately, Job's friends are kind of saying the same thing that Satan is saying. They're just, Satan says, you know, Job serves you for what he gets out of it, right? Job serves you, in essence, for earthly reasons. That's ultimately what Satan's saying, right? You bless him, you give him camels, you give him all this stuff. That's why he serves you. Job serves you for earthly reasons. Satan says, so take away that stuff, Job will curse you to your face. All right? That's Satan's basic argument. Job's friends, while not siding with Satan, Job's friends believe in God. They believe that God is powerful and righteous, but their argumentation is actually surprisingly similar. They say, they deduce, because God is clearly good and God is clearly righteous, God is clearly sovereign, he's in control. Well, if you're being cursed like this, the only logical deduction is what? You sinned.
Right, which in essence is not the type of wisdom that ultimately Job was exemplifying in the first two chapters, right?
Exactly.
So it indicates, like, time after time after time, like, argument, after reasoning, after logic, after, you know, course of discussion. No, the wisdom is in seeking what God's doing here. I don't get it, but I didn't sin, it wasn't me.
Right, because they're basically saying the same thing. If you serve God, you'll get kind of, if you want to put it this way, kind of almost like instant gratification. You'll have instant blessing, you know? And so once again, the problem is they're making it all earthly. They're making it all physical. They're saying, if you obey, you have kind of instant physical blessing. I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but they're basically saying the same type of thing that Satan was saying, and that they're making it not about faith. See, that this is where it ties into the main purpose of the book. They're not making about faith. If Job's friends were right, it would be kind of like I said earlier, you know, you obey God, boom, instant blessing. Here's cash falling out of heaven. You disobey God, boom, instant punishment. Right? That's how Job's friends are thinking about it. And if that were right, once again, there would be no need for faith. There would be no need to fear God, because you don't need faith or to fear that which you can see. And I would say that since the main point is to fear God, the point of this book is reinforced by these arguments showing, no, this is not the case that there's a one-to-one correspondence. It's not all about what you can see. It's life is more than what you can see. There's a purpose in the world that's broader than just you obey, instant blessing. That's not how the world works. And so it basically, if I could put it this way, the argument of the book of Job takes our eyes off of the earthly, focuses it on the heavenly, and the main point of the book is God is beyond you. You can't understand him. Job's friends thought they understood God. They thought they had it all figured out. They thought it was really simple, right? But that's not the case. That's not how the world works. If that was how the world works, you would have everything figured out. You wouldn't have a need to seek God for wisdom. You wouldn't have a need to fear him, because you got it all figured out. And so that's what was so wrong with Job's friends' reasoning, is that they reduced God to, I don't know, a cosmic Santa Claus. You know, that you're naughty or nice and you get presents or not. Right? And they reduce it to where there's no need to fear God and to understand how great God is and to submit to him in holy reverence. And so that's where those speeches play into it. And then, as we said, there's chapter 28, which is just this, in my opinion, kind of flashing red sign that says this is the main point. And then you kind of have the end of the book, which is the speech of Elihu, which rebukes Job for his, if you will, kind of getting in the face of God a little bit and blaming God more than he should have. And then you have God's speech himself, where God just appears in awesome power in order to say, Look at how wise I am. You cannot figure me out. And that's an oversimplification, but that's what God says. God says, I am awesome. You need to fear me. And so you see that the theme of fearing God is the main theme in each one of these apparently disconnected sections of the book. And in each one of these sections, you keep pointing up and saying, God is bigger than you are. You can't figure him out, Job's three friends. God is bigger than you are, Job. When this trial goes on, you know, in the first two chapters, you may not know why. God is bigger than you are, Job. You can't orchestrate this whole world and this whole universe. You can't figure it all out. And so therefore, the only, you come to the end of the book, hopefully our response will be the only response that there can be, to say, okay, I can't figure it out. I'm not God. I don't understand. Right? And so therefore, I'm going to submit to God. I'm going to worship God and let God be God. And that's what faith is. And that's what this book calls us to. And if that's what we get out of this book, I think we understand the message of it.
There's a big drive. There's always been a big drive to try to understand your circumstances, try to understand how people look at things, how other people would think differently, to understand each other, people. And I think that there's even been a drive to try to understand God. And this book totally wipes that clean off the... it's not on our to-do list. It's not on our to-do list to try to understand God. And this book instead teaches us that we need to know who God is rather than understand what he is. To know him as this person who is all-powerful, almighty, your redeemer, who loves you, and who can save you. Yeah. Beyond that, things happen, but he is a rock. He's the anchor for you to hold on to. I mean, that's what it means.
Yeah. That's good. That's good.
I think it's interesting the similarities between the way God talks about Paul and the way he talks about Job. Like he says, God says to the disciples, like, go get Saul and bring him because he's useful to me, I think is the word. And they're all scared about it. They say, no, go get him. He's a chosen vessel of mine. I'll show him how much he must suffer for my sake.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the
almost
exactly the right word. It's like, I'll show him how much he's going to suffer for my sake. And like, that's kind of the same conversation God has with Satan and all the angels here, all the sons of God here. It's interesting to me that suffering is correlated with, you know, great men exercising faith. You know, whether it's bodily or monetarily or, you know, all the litany of things that Paul suffered. You know, I was shipwrecked and hungry and all this.
Stoned.
Yeah, I was stoned. And then I just was reminded of, like, the beginning of James we've been talking so much about. Because I wondered, trying to string them all together, like, rejoicing in the midst of trials like Job's is a challenging thing, and so I think that's kind of understating it. When he worships, it's a response that has to do little with why whatever is happening is occurring. You know, like someone once told me, like, that why is so much less important than what. And so, since there's no answers to the why questions in Job's case or in Paul's case in a lot of them, he's just, like, always focusing on what's happening. You know, I praise God for the X, Y, Z, and, you know, this other thing. They're all happening, and I'm seeing, like, the steadfastness of my faith increase, and I'm seeing, like, the gospel increase, and I'm suffering for his sake, and these are all good things, even though he's, like, in prison and getting beaten and thinks he's going to die and all this, you know. Because it really had very little to do with the why. It was all about the what. He assumed that there were, like, God's purposes behind it somewhere. Maybe he was reading a lot of Job or something. I just thought it was interesting, the connection about how God talked about them, the way he dealt with them, the way they both suffered, all that.
No, I think you're right. I mean, we could do a whole study, you know, the theology of suffering. And I think, you know, we did go to James. Obviously, that's one of the reasons I picked Job to go to, is because of that clear connection there. It's what we were talking about on Sunday, that really trials are unique in that they are what refine and test our faith. And of course, the metaphor that the whole Old Testament is full of, and the New Testament as well, is the idea of a refiner's fire that comes in and takes faith. And there's nothing like a trial to show the reality of what faith is and to refine that faith. You know, when you lose everything, you see that what's really valuable anyway, right? If you're Job and you lose everything and you have nothing left, it shows you that the only thing that's worth anything is God, right? So suffering and trials have this refining effect on us. But they also, and kind of that, once again, that dual purpose, not only do they refine our faith and they make it more pure as gold that gets refined going through the fire over and over, but they also have that effect of showing that the faith is real, that the gold is real, as we could see in Job's case. And so trials are, I think, as we look throughout the New Testament and the Old Testament both, trials are a necessary and important part of what it means to be a Christian. I mean, even that, I just taught the pastoral epistles, that statement that Paul makes that those who desire to live righteous in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. And it's just kind of a challenging thought that trials are kind of, it's not a side thing for being a Christian. It's an integral, important part of what it means to be a believer, because of the effect that it has on our faith and how it shows that God is worth it more than anything else. Once again, if God just, you became a Christian, your life became cushy, right? It doesn't show that God is worth serving, you know, but when you go through torture and suffering or whatever else for the name of Christ, what you're telling the world is God is worth more than anything else. That's what you're saying.
I think it's interesting, too, that like when God brings suffering, you have to start saying that, even though I wonder how many times God brings suffering into my life because he knows I'm thinking something other. Oh, I deserve this. Oh, it's not that important monitoring how much I value God. It's not that valuable for me to pursue him every day. I wonder how many times he does that. Right. Well, I mean, that's what Hebrews 12 says about discipline.
Yeah.
I guess that's obvious, but nevertheless, I'm kind of reminded of it. Like, how many times do I give myself messages of reassurance that have little to do with faith, and then God refines those out of me by sending trial? It doesn't have to be every time, you know. I could be like Job, be blameless and upright and all that, and still get my candlestick in the way, but.
Good. Just when you start to desire something a little bit too much, God in his grace sometimes will take it away to remind us, right?
Right.
Exactly. To remind us that he's the one that's truly valuable.
It's interesting that you know, he's had all the material things stripped away, and then he lost his children and his friends are not exactly, you know, really warm and embracing him. And then his wife says, why don't you just kind of dry up and blow away? You know what I mean? It's just like, wow, he didn't even have the comfort of his, you know, who we would assume, at least in our contemporary thought, the most intimate, closest friend was not really there supporting him.
Yeah.
You know, it's just kind of like, it must be a really, I mean, he must have really just felt like he was out there on the pinnacle all by himself.
Yeah, losing his health too.
Right. And that's when you really see the necessity of being connected with God.
And that's why I think that this book is so amazing, how it ends with just a big view of God. Right? That's what we need more than anything. We need a huge, big picture of the awesomeness of God. And if that is present with us, then we will, when we go through a trial, we'll understand, okay, I'm not God. I'm not in control. I don't understand everything. We'll understand that, okay, God's wisdom is greater than my wisdom. I will submit and worship and not, I mean, it'll really, it is pride, right? When we go through a trial and we think, you know, what are some of the thoughts that we tend to think? Oh, I don't deserve this, or this isn't what's best for me, or this is how it should go. It's flat out just pride, right? We think we know better than God how things should go. We think we know better than God how our life should be planned out. And it's pride. And when we submit ourselves and we understand, okay, God knows a little bit better than I do what will be best for me, what will be best for him, right? That's how, when we're going to respond rightly, we're going to respond in worship. I think, too, probably if there's other comments or questions, you could certainly ask those. But I think, too, I mentioned this briefly, and this is kind of how I ended on Sunday, but it's good to be reminded as well that as much as Job is an example of faith here, how he exhibits amazing faith and fear in God, his response, the end of chapter 1 is just exemplary and model and all of that, that, you know, you come to chapter 3, you come to some of these disputes back and forth, and you can see that this is a man who's wrestling hard. He is wrestling really hard with his faith. Chapter 3, verse 1, afterward, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And he just goes on and on. It's like, you know, why was I even born? And you go through these debates with his friends. And I like the book of Job because it's so real. It's so real. Job is, I would say that it seems to me as you get to the end of the book that he definitely even crosses a line in a sense that he goes a little bit farther than he should have in his declaration of his innocence. Because certainly he was innocent, but in his declaring his innocence, he's basically saying, God, you know, I want you to come into court with me, and I will prove that I am innocent to you. And he gets pretty bold in his language to God. And that's where I would say when God speaks to Job, he puts him in his place. Right, you see that at the end. It's well, we could read that again. We read it on Sunday, you know. But you know, as Job's friends start accusing him, he gets so bold in his defense of himself that he almost gets to the point of accusing God of wrongdoing, because he's like, "I'm righteous. This is just God." And he kind of is like, "I need to go to court with God, and then I'll be proven right." And we'll kind of look at this maybe a little bit on Sunday, but the reason I bring it up here is just a reminder that certainly in chapter 1 and 2, you see his awesome response of faith that exhibits his fear of God and his trust in God and his faith. But you also see the raw side of Job. If you read through, you know, we're not going to read through all of chapters 3 through, you know, 30, whatever. But you see that this was a tough trial to go through. And it's not that, I think it's easy for us, especially when we're not going through a trial, to kind of get this idea that it's easy to respond this way, or that somehow we just kind of magically blink our eyes 3 times and we'll have a right response or something. We don't understand the kind of grappling with God that took place with Job, and understand how we need such a sure foundation of an understanding of the fear of God in order to be able to respond rightly. And so I think I mentioned those things just to kind of remind us that as much as Job responded rightly, there also was a deep, deep wrestling in his soul with God over the why question, right? I mean, the message of this book is to say that you can't know why, and God, you know, and Job certainly responded rightly from the beginning in terms of that worship, but he wrestled hard over that why question. He wrestled hard over the fact that he served God and he worshiped God, and there is something, I don't know what the right word to put it, there is something of just the fall and the curse and the effects of sin and death on this world where the righteous do suffer. And so, anyway, we'll look specifically at some of that stuff, as I said, on Sunday. But it's a good reminder that you, in the book of Job, you have both aspects. You have his exemplary model of faith and trust in God despite these trials, but you also have a deep, deep wrestling over how a good God could bring this into his life, a God that he had served, a God that he had worshipped. And it's just a reminder to us not to take too light a view of suffering, especially when someone else is going through it and we want to come alongside and care for them. That doesn't just go, you know, kind of pat them on the back and just be like, you know, it'll be all right, God's in control, and shake it off kind of thing. Just remembering how profound sometimes people's suffering can be. And just a reminder as we care for them, yes, to encourage them to look to God, to remember that God has a purpose that we cannot understand, but at the same time, just remembering that sometimes there are dark clouds that come into people's lives that cause them to wrestle deeply over these things. And so I think for me, as you read through, you know, as you were saying, Eric, these kind of long chapters of debate, that's another thing that I kind of get from there is just the reality of that as Job wrestles hard over his circumstances. All right, go ahead.
When Job does come before God to try to prove his innocence, and God responds to him, does he even deal with Job's sin? He doesn't even really deal with the... This is why I'm doing this, Job. He doesn't even deal with that. He just deals with, where were you when I created that earth? He doesn't even go anywhere near Job's plight. He just proves that he's God.
Right. Yep, that's exactly right. And
In essence, he doesn't even really need to respond to Job's palliation.
And Job gets the point, right? And we didn't, I don't think, really spend too much time looking at Job's response. But in verse 40, after God's first speech is in chapter 38 and 39. And in chapter 40, Job has his first response. You know, then Yahweh said to Job, will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Rhetorical question. And obviously the answer is, nope, shouldn't do that. Let him who reproves God answer. Then Job answered Yahweh and said, behold, I am insignificant. What can I reply to you? I lay my hand on my mouth. Once I have spoken, and I will not answer, even twice, and I will add nothing more. And that's the right response. Right? That's the response that God was seeking to have. I am insignificant. Right? We need to think about God and put ourselves in right perspective in light of God, that we're insignificant. Right? God is awesome. God is powerful. We are little. And so we can never get to the point where, or I guess I should say we should never get to the point where in our wrestling over things, and I don't mean to say that we shouldn't ever, I don't know what the right word would be, that there is that profound sense of just the deep wrestling over the circumstance, but I think Job went too far in the sense blaming God. And if we have a true sense of the fear of God, like Job eventually did, you know, he'll understand his place. And so in chapter 42, you have the same thing. In chapter 42, verse 1, then Job answered Yahweh and said, I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Right? Just once again, acknowledging God's greatness, God's sovereignty. Verse 3, who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? You know, that's a quote, if I remember correctly, from earlier where God asked that. And so Job says, Therefore, I have declared that which I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Right? Once again, Job placing himself underneath God's awesome sovereignty. And that's the right response to a full picture of who God is. Just to place ourselves and say, look, this was too great for me. And so he quotes God again, "Hear now and I will speak, I will ask and you instruct me." And then Job says, "I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you, therefore I retract and I repent in dust and ashes." And he recognizes his position before the awesome God.
What is the word wonderful?
Do you know what? I don't have my Hebrew in front of me, but it's kind of like awesome. Wonder, awe, just amazement.
Almost wonderable.
Yeah, it's just too magnificent. You know, it's interesting, too, and I think we could add a word just about the conclusion of the book. And you know what happens. You know that God restores everything to Job. And he gives him all, even twice the blessing that he had before, and more sons and daughters. And I think it's significant. It's funny because a lot of commentators think that it's kind of a cheesy ending to the book. More of the liberal slant. They're like, I should have just left it without that, you know? Like, it was a good book, and then they had to go and ruin it by adding this ending. But and you do ask yourself, well, you know, if the whole point is just the awesomeness of God and the fear of God and that God doesn't always bless you in this life, why end, right? If the whole point is you need to have faith and God doesn't always bless you and the suffering that you experience, you know, you may not understand it, why end with blessing, right? It almost, you know, you could see why people would think it kind of contradicts the message. But I think it's a great, important ending to that this book needs, because ultimately it shows that God does ultimately bless those who fear him. And that's an important reminder, right? Because if this book, in a sense, added that, it almost give you this idea that God is kind of a capricious dictator, right? That you don't understand what he does, and he doesn't always bless those who serve him, and so, you know, you never know. God may just strike you down for no good reason and just kind of is this capricious kind of a God. And so the book ends this way, I would suggest to you, to remind us that ultimately God does bless those who fear him. And that's a very important note to end on, right? We know that it may not always be in this life like it was for Job. We know that sometimes believers die in faith, having been sawn in two, like Isaiah or whatever. You know, you go to Hebrews chapter 11. But for this book to form, if you will, the complete message about this, the author didn't want to leave it in such a way that you could get the impression that God is kind of just out to get people. And just fear him. You know, you never know what he may do. Just fear him, and he may or may not bless you if you do. Right? The message is, no, God does ultimately love. He does ultimately bless those who fear him and serve him. That's who God is. May not be, you may not understand why, it may not be in your timing, but ultimately God is going to do good to those who serve him. And so that's a very important conclusion to this book. Because without that, as we said, we could come away from this book with a wrong understanding of who God is. We might think, well, how could God be just then? How could he be righteous if he punishes Job for no reason? Well, I guess there is a reason, but he didn't deserve it. You know, how could God be good if just, oh, well, you know, there you go, Job. Sorry about that. I just took everything away from you. And just kind of, it'd give you a tainted version of God that doesn't cause you to understand his true righteousness and his justice and his goodness. And so this conclusion holds those things in tension, as they rightly are in this world that's full of sin and death, but it puts the other side of the equation back on and causes us to see, yes, God is good, and God is righteous, and God is fair to Job, even though Job didn't deserve the trial that he went through. And so, as in all of life, you need to hold those things in tension. That yes, God does bless his people. He does reward obedience, but there's still that need for faith and trust in him, because it may not be in your timing, and you may not be able to understand it. And so therefore, you need to submit to the awesomeness of God.
The word is pala, which means to be marvelous or wonderful or surpassing or separated, beyond your power or difficult to do or understand, extraordinary. To do something wondrously, to show it marvelous. It's got the idea of just something like, kind of obvious, you know, same sort of use we have.
Yeah.
It's interesting, too, that if we're talking about Job, and it's too wonderful for Job to understand, you know, I think it would be easier for us to accept that it's difficult for us to understand. The more minute the thing, the harder it's going to be to figure out God's ultimate idea here. It's like your entire life melts down, you know, to where there's nothing left of you. Maybe it's more obvious that Satan's got a contest with God going on, you know. But if it's some small thing, like, we should just trust God in faith and move on, you know. We don't always have to figure every little detail out. Maybe I'm preaching myself, but...
Yeah, that's good. All right, so there we have it. That's kind of another angle at Job and looking at it once again, just the fear of Yahweh. And we'll be talking a lot about the fear of Yahweh as we move to Proverbs and maybe Ecclesiastes. But if you want wisdom, you got to start by knowing that you need it. And so for all of us, that's where we're going to start. We're going to start with just the reminder that we don't have everything figured out, right? We can't. If you have, just for your devotion sometime, you know, read through chapters 38, 39, 40, 41, 42 there. Just read that section. It's such an awesome description of God. And I think we all need to be continually reminded, because we don't see God, right? God does call for faith. We don't... like we said, we don't get $1,000 bills instantly every time we obey. We need those reminders of how awesome God is continually. And so it would be good, I think, for your heart just to read 38, 39, 40, and 41 and just be reminded of how awesome God is. And I think that should, it should hopefully just continually be instilled within our hearts. And I think even too, I was reading a blog and it was Gunner's blog, most of you know Gunner, and he had a list of like things he learned in 2008, and one of the things he put in there is three things make me sane or keep me sane, and he said it's like laughter, children, and going outside. And I kind of just like that. It's, there's something about going outside and looking around that kind of reminds me of things like chapters 38 through 41. You know, it just reminds us that God is bigger than we are. And I think for me too, it's one of those things that sometimes I just need to go out and look at the mountains and be reminded of how small I am. Go out and look at the stars and put everything in perspective, right? Because I tend to think that I can figure everything out and I'm the one that can master my own domain and my own future and I can, you know, plan it all out and, you know, work it all out exactly how it's supposed to be. But I just need those reminders that, no, that's God's job. And I just need to live in light of who he is. So, all right, any concluding thoughts or questions? All right, well, let's close in prayer and then we can fellowship together. Our Father, we thank you for this book. We are very much reminded of how awesome you are. And we just thank you for the time just to meditate on it again and the message of it. I pray that all of us would increase in our faith just as we're reminded of these truths. And we would grow and learn to fear you more. Lord, I pray that when we go through trials or we are like Job's friends who come to comfort people in their trials, that we would have these truths in our minds as we do so. And if we're seeking to comfort someone who's going through a trial, that we would not be like Job's three friends who were such worthless counselors, who didn't see your eternal perspective, and they thought that they had you all figured out, but in reality they were thinking merely on an earthly scale. And I pray as well that when we go through a trial, that we would look up and that we would see our place in your plan, and we would just stand in awe of what you are doing. I pray that you give us the strength to worship as Job did when we go through this life and through the difficulties in it. And we want to give you all the praise and the glory and the honor. We thank you for this time. In Christ's name, amen.